All rise.
Welcome to the Cyber Law and Business Report. Get the top story on the hot-button internet legal topics of the day. This is your home for the latest on internet law and policy. Hear the latest net trends impacting business and have your questions answered right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report. Now, please welcome your host, the founder of the Internet Law Center, Bennett Kelly.
Good morning. This is Bennett Kelly broadcasting live from the Internet Law Center here in downtown Santa Monica in the heart of Silicon Beach. Please be seated. We have a great show for you today, but put on your acronym hat. We're going to be throwing them at you pretty quickly, FYI. And today we have Jeremy Malcolm with us from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF. And he's going to be talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement, most commonly referred to as TPP. And there'll be a number of other acronyms thrown about, but it's a very important agreement that has been signed by President Obama and several other countries throughout Asia. We covered this in episode 192, where we had a guest from the Chamber of Commerce kind of walk us through the pro side. So as we are now in the final of 4 days of protest in Washington against the TPP, this was a good point to bring on Jeremy to explain the TPP from the opposite viewpoint. And there's some compelling arguments against TPP of the presidential candidates. Surprisingly, only two apparently of the major candidates support TPP in its present form. So, Jeremy, are you with us?
Yes, thanks for having me.
And pleasure to have you. Now, Jeremy's background, actually, he joined the EFF in 2014 and works on the international dimensions of issues such as intellectual property, network neutrality, internet governance, and trade. And he's actually having spent several years in Indonesia working on trade issues, including the TPP. And as you can tell, Jeremy is Australian. He's a lawyer admitted both in Australia and New York. So, Jeremy, welcome. So tell us what's going on right now on TPP in Washington.
Sure. Well, as you've mentioned, there are protests on the ground right now. We have one of our experts, Myra Sutton, there with the other activists actually protesting. It's sad that it's come to this, that the policymakers weren't able to listen to us before it got to the stage of protests, but that's where we're at, because despite all of the efforts that we had to improve the agreement and to cut out some of the bad provisions, we were disappointed by the final text, and so now we have to send a strong message to Congress saying we just don't want it to be signed at all.
And in terms of who is we in kind of a broad sense? What is the coalition against TPP?
Well, the protesters in D.C. at the moment are not a formal organized group. It's really an open demonstration which a number of groups are participating in, and anyone can join in. There are a few coalitions. There's one that's focused on the IP issues in the agreement, which EFF has been focusing on because of our one of our areas, of course, is IP. So we have a coalition called Our Fair Deal, which is focused on that. But there are also broader coalitions. We work with labor groups, environmental groups, and farmers and other groups that are interested in other aspects of the TPP, broader than what we are. There's some strange bedfellows in some ways with the groups that we're involved with, but everyone agrees that this process is wrong. It's too closed. It doesn't take into account the public interest. It's captured by big corporations. And so everyone from all colors of the political spectrum is coming together in D.C. with behind these protests.
So let's kind of back up and explain TPP, what it is, and also what's unusual about it. So TPP is involved. The signatories are Brunei, Chile, New Zealand, Singapore, Australia, Canada, Japan, Malaysia, Mexico, Peru, United States, and Vietnam. And the idea is to create kind of like a Pacific common market. Is that a fair assessment?
Pretty much. It began as a smaller agreement just between four of those countries, and it only became the giant thing that it is after the United States joined, and then sometime later when Japan joined. So as it stands now, it's potentially the largest free trade agreement in the world outside of the WTO, which is the World Trade Organization, which is essentially a global structure. But this is the largest regional trade agreement that we have. The other one that's of comparable size is being negotiated between the US and Europe right now, and that's called TTIP. So TPP plus TTIP together will cover the majority of trade in the world. And having said that, there's definitely an imbalance between some of those countries. So when you look at countries like Brunei, which is tiny, it's just a little island off Malaysia, and the United States, obviously there's a very significant difference in power there. So you can guess who is writing the rules. Generally,
right.
The U.S. Pushing its preferences onto these other countries.
So I have Donald Trump on the other line. He wants to know if China is part of this agreement.
So China is not part of the agreement. This is the thing that was often people would speculate that the TPP was a weapon against China. To some extent, that seems to be true. But because China isn't directly a party, it's not obviously going to be binding in any way on China. So some of the provisions in there on things like government procurement and disclosure, you know, rules that prohibit a country from requiring disclosure of software source code and rules on cyber espionage. These are things that seem to be targeted at China, but nevertheless, China is not a party. So what the rationale seems to be is that if we can establish these rules as regional norms, then there will be some pressure on China to conform, even though it's not actually signed up.
Well, with the when we had the Tammy Overton of the Chamber of Commerce on, she said that, obviously China is not a member, but they would envision at some point China becoming a member, or that would be a goal. One of the arguments they make against, in terms of why we need to do the deal is otherwise those Asian countries will do a deal with China, and that will promote China's hegemony in the region.
Well, that's happening anyway. There's a Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, RCEP, also being negotiated between the Asian countries themselves, including not only China but also India, but excluding the United States. So TPP won the race to the finish line, being concluded prior to the RCEP. Otherwise, RCEP would have stolen some of TPP's thunder. But RCEP is continuing nonetheless, and that will be a significant agreement if they're able to conclude that in the next 12 to 18 months, which looks pretty likely. So we are going to have a different agreement with China, certainly not going to have the same standards in terms of things like intellectual property and so on, but the TPP is not going to insure against China's dominance in the region. China is naturally going to be dominant in the region regardless of the TPP, and so I don't think that the strategy of containing China is very likely to succeed.
And one thing, this is that thing about over a billion people kind of gets your attention. But I'm going to have to speak in somewhat hushed tones right now, because one thing that seems odd about this agreement from the start is its secrecy. You know, NAFTA, wasn't necessarily done the same way. NAFTA being the North American Free Trade Agreement, which was negotiated under the Bush administration and then kind of finalized under the first year of President Clinton and then passed. Why was TPP so secretive? And is that the new norm for trade agreements?
It's not really a new norm. It's actually what we always hear from the negotiators is that it's secret because that's the way it's always been done, which is relatively true. But the thing is that trade agreements have changed since the early days of NAFTA. Well, NAFTA is not really the early days, but since from the early days up until NAFTA, we didn't have so many of the same issues that we do now appearing in trade agreements. So IP has only been in trade agreements for just over a decade since it was introduced at the World Trade Organization. And we're getting new issues like e-commerce and telecommunications and things that we've never seen before are actually in this TPP. For example, domain name rules, rules about encryption, rules about free flow of information across borders. So these are the kind of things that we wouldn't expect to have negotiated in secret, unlike maybe things like the rates of tariffs and quotas. You can understand why those would have to have a level of discretion around them. But these broader public policy rules shouldn't be discussed in private because they really do require a broad public discussion around these, because they're fundamental, you know, issues that affect all levels of our society. You can't just say that they're only of interest to people engaged in trade.
Right.
So one thing that we've seen in the TTIP, as I mentioned, is the European Agreement, which stands for Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. The negotiators on the other side, on the European side, have been more transparent than the US. They've released all of their textual proposals for the TTIP, and the US hasn't followed suit. So they've heard some of the call for transparency, and they've begun to heed that, but the US is lagging behind. And in the TPP, despite the constant leaks, there were some chapters that we hadn't seen at all until a few weeks ago when the text had already been agreed.
So let's walk through, obviously the EFF opposes the TPP. Why? Let's do one at a time.
So, as I alluded to, we've got a number of other parties in the loose coalition that are interested in other chapters of the TPP, but we're mainly interested in the IP chapter, the e-commerce chapter, to some extent the telecommunications chapter, and the investment chapter. So, beginning with the IP chapter, one of the problems that we have there is that it gives, it basically exports the most stringent parts of US law and locks them in place so that we can't change them, but it doesn't export the more permissive aspects of US law that operate as a balancing mechanism here. So, to give a more concrete example, we're exporting the life plus 70 years copyright term to all of the other Pacific countries, and that includes countries like Japan, Canada, New Zealand, Malaysia, Brunei, Vietnam, that are all going to have to increase their copyright term from life of the author plus 50 years to life of the author plus 70 years. So that is going across the board. But what isn't going across the board is the US fair use exception to copyright, which is one of the things that balances out that harsh and excessive copyright term. So what we would like to have seen is if we're going to be, you know, exporting the harsh stuff, we should export the balancing stuff as well, and that hasn't happened. The rules that benefit the content owners are all binding, and anything that's in favor of users is just, you know, a soft, unenforceable guideline. So it says countries should promote the public domain, they should have exceptions and limitations to copyright, should achieve some balance, but there's no enforceable or hard standards for that stuff. Everything that's hard and enforceable is in favor of the rights holders.
Let me just put a footnote or a coda on that. And there was a recent documentary on exposing Scientology, and the documentarian made a point of saying, "I could not have done this documentary without really fair use." You know, fair use allowed him to use certain footage, to explain what the topic was, what was going on, and so basically a restriction that doesn't encompass fair use, and in some ways limits speech to the extent that allows companies to use such content to expose and explain issues. And if you require the company to consent to anything that they can use the withholding consent to basically prevent negative content.
Yeah, and it wouldn't be so bad if there weren't such high penalties for infringing copyright, because if you take, as a documentarian, if you take some footage and you use it without permission and you don't have a fair use exception to rely upon, then you could be liable not only for civil penalties but for criminal penalties. So it actually can involve going to jail for infringing copyright. The reason why is because the US has included language in the TPP about commercial scale infringement, which includes not only traditional sort of piracy, as in, things like manufacturing fake DVDs and CDs, but also any other copyright infringement that's committed on a commercial scale, whether or not you actually make any money from it. So a documentarian may not make money, but if they distribute hopefully they would like to make money, but you know how these things go, they don't always do so. So if they release a film and it's downloaded 10,000 times, that may be a commercial scale, regardless of whether it pulls in a return on investment for them. So that could be a criminal infringement. And this is something that many countries didn't have before. They did limit criminal penalties to those who are like pirate factories who are churning out counterfeit goods. So we think that's, in conjunction with the fact that fair use isn't required, that's really dangerous.
We are not a documentary. Hopefully we are making money. So we're going to take a short break for our sponsors. This is Ben and Kelly. You're listening to Cyber Law and Business Report. We'll be back after these messages.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
Celebrating the best in online advertising, the Web Marketing Association presents the 14th Annual Internet Advertising Competition Awards. Submit your banner ads, email ads, rich media, online newsletters, websites, and social media campaigns now by going to iacaward.org. Deadline for entries is February 15th, 2016. All winners will have their entry highlighted on the Internet Advertising Competition website, as well as receive a handsome trophy to display or a personalized certificate of achievement. Be honored among your online advertising peers by submitting your entry into the Web Marketing Association's 14th Annual Internet Advertising Competition Awards. Submit your entry today at iacaward.org. That's iacaward.org.
Reinventing keyword research, simplifying campaign optimization, redefining competitive analysis. SpyFu brings you an entirely new way to find the most profitable keywords for your SEO and PPC campaigns. New tools, new data, and a brand new look. We've streamlined SpyFu so that you can optimize your search engine marketing more efficiently, more accurately, and more intuitively. Visit SpyFu.com. That's SpyFu.com. And start downloading your competitors' keywords now. Try it free.
Looking for a better way to get more traffic and interaction to your Facebook page? Imagine Facebook interactivity on your page like you've never seen. Introducing your new Facebook marketing fix. Zoe Social, the new and revolutionary way to easily manage and automate your Facebook contests and sweepstakes. Create a fun, easy-to-win contest by writing a simple Facebook post. Watch your post go more viral and generate loads of interaction. Track your traffic and generate email lists with ease. Zoe Social is mobile-friendly and complies with Facebook terms of service. Let Zoe Social give your Facebook page some flash today. Zoom over to zosocial.com.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on webmasterradio.fm.
Interestingly enough, looking at today in history, NAFTA was approved by the U.S. House on this day in 1993. So we're back and we're talking about the new agreement, the TPP, and we're talking with Malcolm, Jeremy Malcolm with the EFF. And next week, 2 weeks from now, as we come to Giving Tuesday, following Thanksgiving, and we open up our checkbooks to worthy causes. EFF has been a great friend to this show, and so I hope you would consider them in your Giving Tuesday plans. So, with that being said, Jeremy, we're going through kind of the principal arguments against TPP. And obviously one of them is the copyright issue, which, and some Canadian scholars have said would eliminate vast amounts of public domain material. What are some of the other concerns that EFF has?
One of them is on DRM or digital locks. This would extend and lock in the system that the US has, which prevents you from bypassing these technologies that stop you from making copies, even if those copies are for lawful purposes. It does allow countries to make exceptions to the rules against circumventing digital locks or DRM, but it doesn't require them to do so. So once again, this is a case where all of the mandatory rules are in favor of the copyright owners, but any of the rules that are in favor of users are voluntary. Now, how does this affect users? Well, I mean, if you've got an e-book and it doesn't work on the particular tablet that you want to use it on, then you might have to crack the DRM to be able to read it, and that would be not only a copyright infringement, but could in some circumstances, again, be a criminal offense. And this is even if you're not planning to make any unlawful use of it, even if you're just planning to crack the DRM for purposes of reading it, which copyright law allows, doing so can still be an offence. So this is an area which we've been grappling with for a long time in the US, and here we have a system where every 3 years, if you want to have an exception to these anti-circumvention rules, you have to go to the Library of Congress and request an exception and explain why you deserve one. And we've been going back every 3 years to ask for exceptions for things like unlocking mobile phones, for repairing your car, for moving movies from one format to another format. And we've been granted these exceptions, but the ridiculous thing is that we have to keep going back every 3 years to renew these exceptions. Now, in the TPP, other countries aren't forced into adopting that style of 3-year exception system, but they do have to have some form of protection for digital locks, and there's no compulsory exception for lawful uses like format shifting and archival and security research. So that's something else that we are disappointed about. And one other thing that we're disappointed about is a provision on trade secrets which is much broader than we've ever seen before. So trade secrets are typically a kind of pseudo intellectual property that prevents someone who receives a secret in confidence from misusing that secret. So that's been part of international law for a while, but this provision goes further and says that if you use a computer system to access or disclose a trade secret, then that can be a criminal offence. Interestingly, this only requires you to access a trade secret using a computer system, even if you don't disclose it to anyone else. You're still in breach of this trade secret provision. So this is much broader than under the World Trade Organization's agreement called TRIPS. It's really a combination of a traditional trade secret law with something closer to a cyber espionage law that criminalizes accessing a computer system without authority. So this, we worry, could impact on whistleblowers and on journalists who may use a computer system to access secrets as part of their research. There's no requirement in the TPP for a public interest exception or a journalism exception. So this could have a chilling effect, and it's the first time we've seen language exactly like this in a trade agreement.
Now, and there's also language on net neutrality, I think, that people are concerned might be too weak. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, so up until now we've been mainly talking about the IP chapter, but there's a whole separate chapter on e-commerce, which contains a number of different things, ranging from spam to net neutrality to the free flow of information across borders. So this net neutrality provision is a strange one. It's almost just checking the box to supposedly cover net neutrality, but in a really ineffective and weak way. Although it's not harmful, it's not actively harmful like some of the provisions in the IP chapter, it could be indirectly harmful if other countries look to this as the maximum bar of protection of net neutrality that they need to worry about, and it could prevent us from striving for more meaningful protections across the world. It's basically just saying there needs to be also privacy is treated in much the same way. So privacy and net neutrality are both name checked, if you like, in the TPP.
Right.
So there's a reference to them, but in terms of binding obligations on countries to do anything significant, there's nothing. It's basically just do something. It doesn't really matter what it is.
And isn't there a provision on privacy that, if industry creates some voluntary standards, that should be sufficient?
Yeah, exactly. So supposedly this is their way of dealing with criticisms that the TPP doesn't account for privacy, but it doesn't go far enough. So it says if you want to, throughout the agreement, there are provisions that say you have to allow, for example, the free flow of information across borders. If there is a compelling argument that you need to protect users' privacy, then you can do that only if it is not a disguised restriction on trade. The problem is that who's going to decide whether something is a legitimate privacy protection or a restriction on trade? It's going to be basically an investment court that's going to have to determine whether there's been a breach of this provision. And history has shown us that these trade courts are very partial to the pro-trade argument and not very skilled in determining whether there are legitimate public interest arguments. So in other trade agreements, environmental protections have been struck down, public health protections have been ruled invalid, and there's every likelihood that privacy protections will also be found to be an impermissible restriction on trade.
So, I mean, case in point, when the German government tried to phase out nuclear power following the Fukushima disaster, they were hit with a lawsuit under a trade agreement.
Yeah. That's exactly what happens, because these trade courts or tribunals don't have human rights expertise, they don't have environmental expertise or public health expertise, and these decisions come down with a very extreme bias towards free trade. And so despite the fact that, you know, privacy is mentioned in the agreement, we can't have much hope that it's going to be taken seriously if this ever comes to a dispute.
And how is the tribunal chosen?
Well, there are two different types of trade dispute under the TPP. One of them is where countries have disputes against each other. And the other one, which is more concerning, is where private investors have complaints against a country. And they can use this system set up in the investment chapter, which allows a private court constituted by trade lawyers to decide the dispute between the investor and the country. And these courts have been roundly criticized for their bias. Because they're constituted by trade lawyers, often the judges in one case will be the advocates in another case, and this obviously sets up a significant conflict of interest. In the European TTIP that I've been mentioning, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, they've thrown out that model in favor of a brand new investment court system that is designed to be more neutral. But the TPP still uses this old system of investment tribunals staffed with lawyers. So the bias that's inherent in that system has not been fixed for the TPP. It's basically just business as usual, and we're likely to get decisions like the one that you mentioned, where a country was penalized for its decision to address nuclear power safety concerns. Other cases include a case against Australia where it has been sued by the Philip Morris cigarette company over plain packaging laws for cigarettes. It was claimed by Philip Morris that this law, even though it was made for public health reasons in Australia, was an impermissible restriction on its trademark rights. So the TPP does allow for these similar sorts of cases to go forward. They've tried to tinker around the edges a bit to stop some of the worst abuses, but in practice we'll have to see whether those changes come to anything or not. And since the reforms aren't as significant as what the Europeans have decided to go for, I'm really worried that we're still going to see some public interest laws struck down by investors.
And so let's say I'm Canada, for example, or it could be any country. They pass one of those laws, you know, whatever it may be, and the tribunal that hears this, how likely is there to be even a Canadian or Malaysian, whichever country is the, you know, the origination of the dispute, to have one of their even own members on a tribunal?
Yeah, well, the board of the panelists on these tribunals are a very small number, and some research has been done which actually ran some statistics on this and worked out the percentage of these disputes that are actually heard by a single trade lawyer, and it's pretty frightening what a narrow group it is. And certainly you're right that you can't expect that a trade dispute will be heard by someone from your own country. So this is, along with the IP chapter, the investment chapter is probably the most threatening in the entire TPP.
And so where are we at now? Because, you know, Congress has passed fast track authority, and which means, and the president has signed the agreement. So what has to happen for it to go into effect or to block it?
So Congress has an up or down vote on this, which means they have to accept the whole thing or none of it. And the pressure is really on, because even though there are many provisions that well, Republicans and Democrats alike would take issue with, they can't quibble with particular sections. They have to take all or nothing. And this puts immense pressure on them to pass the agreement. And that's what the negotiators are relying upon. They think that it's going to be too costly for them to throw out the TPP and too politically difficult to renegotiate it. So that's what the demonstrations in D.C. are about. They're about trying to point out that if you can't get what you want, you shouldn't sign on to the dotted line at all. You should actually reject the whole thing.
Does Congress have to vote by a certain time period, or?
Yeah, so the calendar, I don't have the dates in front of me, but there was 30 days from when the president notified Congress of his intention to sign the agreement. That's the next deadline that's coming up. But in terms of once the U.S. and the other countries sign, there'll still be a further delay because the U.S. has a process called certification, whereby it has to certify that the other countries have passed their implementing laws in a fashion that complies with U.S. expectations. So the U.S. obligations to other countries won't arise until this certification process has gone through. And that could take years, depending on how long the other countries take to put their implementing laws in place. So even after Congress signs, there'll be a long phase out of, or phase in rather, of the TPP obligations on the U.S. and on the other countries.
But does Congress have to act now? If it doesn't do anything, does it still go into effect? Or I guess procedurally, that's what is.
Yeah, no, there's no imperative to sign immediately in the sense that the thing won't lapse if it doesn't get signed straight away. But on the other hand, it won't come into effect until we have a requisite number of signatures as well. So it's an outside chance that we can defeat this in Congress, but the same battle is going on in other countries. And if we do manage to convince a sufficient number of countries not to sign, then the TPP won't go into effect. It's not impossible that this could happen. The Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, or ACTA, was another example of this, where they concluded the agreement. All of the countries had signed it, but they hadn't all ratified it. And in the end, when demonstrations in Europe convinced the European Parliament not to ratify the agreement, that stalled the entire thing. And ACTA is basically a dead letter now. It's still on the books, but not enough countries have ratified it for it to come into effect. So it is possible, even though it's an outside chance, but still technically possible that the same thing could happen to the TPP, and that even though it's been agreed, it isn't ratified in enough countries to take effect.
How different is ACTA from TPP in terms of, you know, its provisions such as copyright?
Well, ACTA was focused on enforcement, and the TPP does have an IP enforcement part in the IP chapter. So TPP can be regarded as a broader agreement than ACTA, and it actually was more stringent than ACTA in a number of respects as well. So you can sort of think of the TPP as a super ACTA.
Okay, well, we're going to take one last break. We come back, we'll wrap up our discussion of the TPP and get you on your way. This is Bennett Kelly. You're listening to Cyber Law and Business Report, only on webmasterradio.fm.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
Introducing Rumble, the smart mobile management system, the first end-to-end mobile platform where you can make real-time app modifications from a point-and-click dashboard. Want to change the design of your app? Point-click, and it's live in real-time. Want to change the ad map of your app? point, click, and it's live in real time. Want to change the content mix of your app? Point, click, and it's live in real time. Power your mobile business with Rumble.
Are you ready to rumble?
Visit www.rumble.me.
Is buying something that is made in the USA important to you?
How do you know that it really is made in the USA?
Certified Inc. is the only supply chain audit company on the planet which qualifies country of origin labeling. If it's important to you as a consumer to know where the products you buy and use in your own home come from, then it's also important for your customers. Visit us at madeinusa.net and find out more. Go to madeinusa.net because it's that important.
Hey, this is Danny Sullivan to talk to you about Bruce Clay Incorporated. They've made Inc. Magazine's list of growing private businesses and have exhibited and sponsored at my conferences since the very beginning. You've seen their search engine relationship chart or you've read their SEO code of ethics, seen other SEO experts, but did you know they can help you with PPC, web analytics, web design, marketing strategy, promotion, and branding? Yep, get everything you need for success in the online marketplace. You can check it out from the professionals at Bruce Clay Incorporated. For over 10 years with offices worldwide, they've got the answers you need. Check them out today at BruceClay.com.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on WebmasterRadio.fm.
And we're back, and we're talking to Jeremy Malcolm with the Electronic Frontier Foundation about the TPP. And just for your information, as usual, on our blog at cyberlawradio.wordpress.com, you can find background information on Jeremy as well as the TPP. I encourage you to check it out. And follow us as always on Twitter at cyberlawradio. And so, Jeremy, we're talking about where this stands. And you said that there might be a chance, you think, that this could actually be stopped within Congress. How optimistic are you?
Well, it's an uphill battle, but battles like this have been won before. We've already just spoken about ACTA, so the other
right.
obvious example is the SOPA and PIPA internet censorship laws, which were once regarded as unstoppable, but then at the end of the day, we did stop them. And you've already also mentioned how all but two of the presidential candidates have come out against the TPP. So public feeling, I think, is certainly on our side. We are up against the might of the industry lobbyists who pushed this agreement from the beginning. So that's our weak point. We certainly can't match the lobbying money that these companies have behind them. Throughout the agreement, we've seen the effect of this. So even Google, which is a big company in its own right, was unable to get the changes that it wanted in the TPP when it came into the negotiations asking for more flexibility. Hollywood was able to prevail because they've been here for longer. They've got more contacts. There's kind of a revolving door thing going on between the US trade negotiators and the entertainment industry and the pharmaceutical industries, where we see former staff of the US trade representative ending up with plum positions at the MPAA, the RIAA, or pharma. And I'm not accusing them of direct corruption or anything like that, but I do think that it has to have an effect in the back of their minds, thinking, well, you know, if I give these industry groups what they want, then, you know, maybe there will be a good job for me waiting a few years later. So it's going to take a long time and a lot of effort for us to overcome this kind of ingrained bias towards those industries. And so although I am hopeful, it would probably be overstating things to say that I'm confident that we can knock the TPP over at the last hurdle, but let's see. Let's keep our fingers crossed.
But I have to think that when you have someone like Hillary Clinton, who had extolled the virtues of the TPP at least over a dozen times, now during the campaign actively come out and oppose the TPP, that has to be some kind of barometer of the strength of the grassroots movement opposing TPP.
Yeah, no one has any doubt about the strength of the grassroots movement. it's really just a case that our political system is really flawed in terms of how it responds to the grassroots compared to the rich lobby groups that have had control of the negotiations since the start. So if everything was right with the US political system, then we could be confident of defeating the TPP. But as it is, our only recourse is to take to the streets, which is what we're doing now, and just hoping that enough of the members of Congress will see that public feeling and that disquiet over these captured trade agreements and make the right decision. So the most I can say is that we're hopeful, and Congress has the chance to do the right thing, but there's a lot of political pressure on them to let this agreement through. So it is at best a touch and go situation, and we'll see soon enough how this plays out.
No, I know you're from the EFF, and we're here primarily talking about the kind of the internet and intellectual property centered issues in the TPP. But the other groups have expressed concerns over, you know, some of the patent issues in terms of its effect it may have on the introduction of generic drugs in other countries, and as well as concerns about its impact on the environment, on labor rights. And I know that's not your that's not your wheelhouse, but is that something you can talk about a little bit?
Well, in general terms, yes. I have mentioned that the pharmaceutical industry lobby group, is one of the strongest industry groups behind the language in the TPP. What often happens, and people don't realize this, but the language that ends up in the TPP actually originates with these lobbyists. They will write out what they want, and they'll give that to the USTR and say, okay, you go and get us this. This is what we want. So in terms of the pharmaceutical provisions, they wanted 8-year protection for biologic drugs in addition to their existing patent rights. And that's pretty much what they got. We did score some wins on that question, so that countries like Australia, which have less than 8 years protection for biologics, could keep that lesser protection as long as they had other measures to compensate for their shorter term of protection. So I don't think that the pharmaceutical industry is 100% happy with what they ended up with, but they still did get the majority of what they wanted. And in terms of the other chapters of the agreement, as I said, I really am focused on only a few of them, but environment and labor activists are generally not too happy with the TPP either, and they're amongst the groups that are rallying in DC this week.
Now, just quickly diverting back to you, you've been active in civil society and internet governance, you know, for a number of years, and you're actually founder of Best Bits. Can you tell us what that is?
Oh, sure. That's it's a group of or a network of civil society groups that are active on internet governance issues, and internet governance is a broad topic which includes some things that come under the TPP. For example, the TPP does have rules about how countries have to manage domain name disputes, and it also says that countries have to make the registration details of people who register domain names publicly available. These are topics that are actually already dealt with in much more transparent internet governance processes, such as ICANN and also the national level domain name processes that exist in many countries. So it's really curious that the US has overridden its commitment to multi-stakeholder internet governance by inserting these agreements into the closed TPP. It actually is pretty hypocritical, to be honest, because they have made a lot of noise about supporting the multi-stakeholder model for internet governance, and yet the TPP is the antithesis of that. It's absolutely not multi-stakeholder. It's completely lacking in participation, and it's top-down, yeah.
So having moved here from Australia and being in San Francisco, which has very strong feelings on this topic, Australian football or American football?
Sorry? Australian. I was never a real big football fan when I was in Australia, but just as my patriotic duty, I will have to go for Australian football.
All right. And you went to Murdoch University. Is that named after Rupert Murdoch?
No, it is not. Murdoch University is, who is it named after? No, there's another famous Murdoch whose name escapes me, but it's not
certainly
named
not
after
Rupert.
No, indeed.
Well, I want to thank you for taking the time to join us and for all the past support from the EFF. If people want to follow you, what's the best way for them to do so?
Well, they can follow EFF via our website and our Twitter account. If they want to follow me personally, they're also welcome to do that. My Twitter handle is a bit weird, though, so I'll have to spell it out. It's QIRTAIBA. It's not an EFF official Twitter account, but I do post work-related things there, so you may find that interesting. Otherwise, EFF's Twitter handle, of course, is just EFF.
Great. And we'll have all that on our show notes on our blog as well. I want to thank you for all your insight. And this is a very critical issue. For listeners, you might want to consult the blog in light of all the acronyms we threw out. But Jeremy, thank you again. It's been a pleasure having you.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure to speak to you.
So I want to thank you, everyone, for joining us for another edition of CyberLaw and Business Report. And be sure to check out our blog, as I mentioned, and also check out the Internet Law Center, internetlawcenter.net. We're a full-service internet firm, and we're actually going to be going to Las Vegas this afternoon for our biannual meeting of the Internet Internet Law Leadership Summit, and look forward to seeing all my colleagues in Internet Law later today and for the next 2 days. So shout out to them. And that's all we have. So join us next week on another edition of CyberLaw and Business Report. This is Bennett Kelly saying be safe out there and have a great week.
This has been a presentation of WebmasterRadio.fm, the world's largest business-to-business radio and podcast network. We welcome you to sample past episodes of this program, as well as our complete library of programs, on demand or on the air via our 24/7 live audio stream at www.webmasterradio.fm. The opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and hosts and do not necessarily reflect those of WebmasterRadio.fm's management or sponsors. Any rebroadcast or redistribution without authorized consent of WebmasterRadio.fm is prohibited.